From WNYC in New York, this is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. A week ago, Kony 2012, a half-hour video about the fugitive Ugandan rebel leader Joseph Kony, was viewed roughly 80 million times in 5 days, breaking the YouTube record set by Britain's Got Talent contestant Susan Boyle. It was produced by the charity Invisible Children and made by co-founder and filmmaker Jason Russell after a chance meeting with one of Kony's child soldiers who saw his brother's throat cut for trying to escape.
He told me more about his brother and what he would say to him if he were still alive.
I love you, but now I miss you. We are not going to meet, but we may meet in heaven, you see. Because if I saw my brother once again, I don't.
It's okay. Jacob, it's okay.
Everything in my heart told me to do something. And so I made him a promise.
And we are also going to do everything that we can to stop them. Do you hear my words? We're going to stop them.
The film immediately sparked a backlash from critics who challenged everything from Invisible Children's governance to its tactics to its portrayal of a complex situation, one that's greatly changed in the years it took to produce the film. The charity quickly opened its books and repeatedly explained its intention to create a tipping point for action. New York Times columnist Nicholas Kristof has spent much of his life exposing human rights abuses and pondering what inspires empathy and action. He's seen how putting the focus on a single figure works.
For example, when the anti-apartheid movement was trying to figure out how to galvanize the public for a long time, they had an effort to free South African political prisoners, and it got nowhere. And then they changed the slogan to Free Mandela, and that took off. And likewise, I think the converse is what we're seeing right now. This Invisible Children video, it's a reminder that there really is an appetite out there if we can figure out how to target it.
So what did they figure out?
Well, one thing that we know intellectually is that it helps to have a bridge character, that Americans don't just want to focus on somebody abroad. And if there is an American who makes the journey to some distant place, or if that person abroad has relatives here, or there's some link, then people are more likely to watch a video or read about it. And they did that with the filmmaker himself and his son and their interest in something a long way away. And if they're interested, then maybe you should be too.
I know Hollywood has taken a lot of hits when dealing with the issue of civil rights in America or humanitarian subjects abroad, and they put an attractive, generally white person in the pivotal role. This is precisely what gets up some of the critics of Invisible Children's nose, the fact that the Ugandans aren't really telling their own story.
If we had people from Uganda, Central African Republic, and Congo telling the story without a bridge character, there would be less impact. If you have an American bridge character, it has more impact. And there's a real trade-off there. It's a little bit less authentic, and there's a trade-off between complexity and simplification.
To what do you attribute the backlash, especially by charities and NGOs, non-governmental organizations in the area that would presumably want the same outcome, Kony behind bars?
Nobody fights more viciously than humanitarians on whatever issue, whether it's microfinance or aid strategies. And it tends to be targeted often at those who are perceived as more aggressive in marketing in ways that make things less complicated. And that's exactly what Invisible Children has done. It's been just a mind-boggling success in marketing with a very simple narrative. And so I think it hits a lot of those buttons.
The backlash has involved not just marketing and oversimplification, but the policies promoted by the film, the presentation of the struggle itself.
The video should have made more clear that the problem used to be in northern Uganda, but that now the problem is Central African Republic, Congo, and to some extent South Sudan. You know, beyond that, I think the critics have been profoundly unfair. you know, I see three people who had voted 9 years of their lives to try to make a difference a long way from home. And it's unclear whether they will make that difference, but I think they're trying in reasonable ways. And I think that is something to be emulated, not scorned.
You're familiar with the Nigerian writer Teju Cole, right?
Sure.
He's been in the forefront of critics who feel that this whole approach is deeply condescending. He even singled out you in one tweet. He said, from Sachs to Christoph to Invisible Children to TED, the fastest growth industry in the U.S. is the white savior industrial complex.
Yeah, there's been a real discomfort and backlash among middle class educated Africans, Ugandans in particular in this case, but people more broadly, about having Africa as they see it defined by a warlord who does particularly brutal things, and about the perception that Americans are going to ride in on a white horse and resolve it. To me, though, it seems even more uncomfortable to think that we as white Americans should not intervene in a humanitarian disaster because the victims are of a different skin color.
Do you believe that the positive attention that the film has gotten is part of the white savior industrial complex?
There's no doubt that it is kind of cool for young Americans to worry about problems halfway around the world, and sometimes to worry more about problems in Malawi than in Newark. On the other hand, I think it is really commendable that a lot of young Americans find that their empathy doesn't stop at the border. And I don't think they should apologize for the fact that they have compassion for families who are being killed and raped and mutilated in the Central African Republic. And just as it was a mistake for us not to intervene early in Bosnia, for example, or in Rwanda, because the issues were seen as complex and distant and remote, I think it's a mistake to turn aside from villagers in Central African Republic and Congo, who I might say are desperate for help from anybody who can possibly provide it.
Thank you very much.
My pleasure, Brooke.
New York Times columnist Nicholas Christoph. Musa Akwanga is a poet, musician, and a blogger based in Britain who recently wrote about the Kony 2012 phenomenon in The Independent. He grew up hearing stories about Kony.
My mother is from Gulu, which is a town that saw many of the abductions, and my father, my late father, who died when I was four, is from Kitgum district, which is just slightly further north of Gulu. So yes, they're both very much from that region.
Now, when this film was first being conceived, that region was beset with catastrophe, but lately it's undergone something of a renaissance. What was your reaction when you saw this place and Kony all over the place last week?
I was utterly bemused, to be honest. A tweeter, I think her handle is Texas in Africa, commented that these days you can get cappuccino and pizza, you know, delivered to your house in Gulu. So it's very different to it was when Kony first started his reign of terror. And when I came home and saw that Stop Kony was trending on Twitter, my first reaction was a sense, I think, of relief that this story had finally, you know, gone viral and it was giving attention to a lot of people, especially young people on Twitter. But I also did think, well, you know, why now? And I suppose that's why I watched the film, and the film only left me with more questions, if I'm honest.
What were the questions it raised for you?
Well, Invisible Children said, you know, the film's half an hour long, we can't get everything in. But I think that a half-hour viral video gives a sense of completeness. It gives the appearance of completeness. And so not to mention really explicitly that Kony had left Uganda in 2006, not to mention the name of President Yoweri Museveni throughout the entire video, when Museveni himself would be integral to any solution, was a huge omission.
He is the head of Uganda and wasn't particularly aggressive in pursuing Kony when he had the chance.
This is a man, President Museveni, who won power through military means in 1986-87, and then for the next 20-odd years was evaded by someone with far inferior forces to those that he'd ever faced before. So that, to me, was a real question mark. And the final problem, I think, which has been borne out by subsequent reaction in northern Uganda to this video, is they didn't seem to really engage Ugandan NGOs or northern Ugandan victims of these atrocities in what they were doing, because there's just been shock and disbelief in northern Uganda as a result of this video.
Right. There were rotten vegetables thrown at the screen during a recent screening. Obviously, the point of this film is to raise awareness. There's a general belief that unless you simplify things, then the awareness doesn't really seep into the general consciousness.
Nobody is particularly served by oversimplifying a story to the point where the omissions themselves become dangerous. So I don't think anybody has a problem with necessarily targeting Kony as a serious problem. But when you have quotes like, you know, Mr. Russell going on and saying that Joseph Kony is the world's worst war criminal, I think it's plain wrong, because actually he's abducted 30,000 people over the course of 26 years. Now, there are people who've killed far, far more than that. I also think that in a half-hour video, you can get plenty more in than just a somewhat binary narrative between good and evil.
Would you assess the general impact of the film as doing more good than harm?
I think so, because fundamentally, the world is a better place for more people knowing about what Joseph Kony has been doing for the last 26 years.
Why? Does it change the reality on the ground?
If we look at why it happened and how it happened, we can unpick these issues. So if we look at Uganda now, if we look at not only Joseph Kony and what he did, but the people who enabled this reign of terror for 26 years, we can say, well, maybe we shouldn't be pumping military aid towards these people unquestioningly. Maybe we should be asking further questions about governance within Uganda.
What do you think about the paternalism argument that, white teenagers need to come in on skateboards and set things right?
I don't like the white savior complex phrase, partly because it feels racist whenever it comes out of my mouth, if I'm honest. I think I do share some of the concerns about paternalism, because this does look like a top-down solution. It does look like there has been very little consultation of people on the ground, NGOs, victims of the LRA and so on. And the reason that paternalism is really a problem actually is because it means you're building ill-fitting solutions for problems because you're not consulting people directly affected by them. That's where I have a real problem.
Musa, thank you very much.
Pleasure's mine. Thank you for having me.
Musa Akwanga is a blogger for the British newspaper The Independent and other publications, and he's also a vocalist with The King's Will.
This is On the Media.
On the Media is supported by Reputation.com, with tools designed to help lawyers, doctors, and business professionals protect and improve their online reputations. More about controlling online reputations at Reputation.com. This is NPR.
This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. Kony is unquestionably a monster, but a true understanding of what kind of monster comes down to a methodical accounting. And in war crimes tribunals and truth and reconciliation commissions, international criminal courts, to say nothing of the court of public opinion, that means body counts. The person most often charged with producing these body counts is statistician Patrick Ball, the go-to tabulator of crimes against humanity. Very simply, Ball's approach is borrowed from ecology and the problems inherent in counting animals. He looks at death lists compiled by aid groups, governments, anyone really, and he charts the overlaps in the lists. Those overlaps reveal how representative a sample is, and knowing the accuracy of a sample enables him to calculate the total number of people killed with real precision. Chart that against all other data available, and he gets a real picture of who was killed and when. Patrick, welcome to the show.
Glad to be here.
Before there was a you, what was the state of the art?
Well, people have been trying to figure out how many people died for a long time. People have done so by looking at transportation mechanisms in the Third Reich, how many people could have been taken to the death camps, for example. People have done demographic approaches comparing different censuses and trying to figure out how many people are essentially missing. People have also done for a long time enumerations, where you try to make a list of every person who is known to have died. Each of those approaches has strengths and weaknesses. None of them gets you to an estimate of true conflict-related mortality by violence.
You actually left out one category, numbers being pulled directly out of the air, such as by Vietnam-era U.S. generals who gave the press what they wanted, hard numbers, albeit not connected to any kind of reality.
I'm sure that some of those numbers were invented out of thin air. Many of them may also have been people's seat-of-the-pants guesstimates based on observed counts. And I think that that's actually something we see a lot of today. People will say, well, we know about 30 or 40 deaths in a particular event or in a series of events in a place, but we think we've only seen half of them, so we'll say there are 60 or 80. And I think that that mix of guessing and direct reporting is very common. What we want to do instead is mix direct reporting with a mathematically reliable estimate.
Tell me, ultimately, why it matters whether 40,000 people were killed or 80,000 people were killed, except for the victims themselves. How do wrong estimates do a disservice to the world at large?
Well, I'm not sure that it matters enormously whether the number is 60,000 or 80,000, but it matters a very great deal how those deaths are distributed. Let me give you some examples. In Peru, working with the Truth and Reconciliation Commission, my colleagues and I observed that there were approximately the same number of deaths reported that were attributed to the Peruvian army and the Shining Path, the Sendero Luminoso, the Maoist guerrillas. So if we had just concluded on the basis of what was reported that the two parties committed equal numbers of deaths, we would have misunderstood the deaths that were not reported. Once we corrected in Peru for the deaths that had not been reported, we realized that Sendero Luminoso was responsible for half again more deaths, and this dramatically changed the understanding of the conflict in Peru. So it's really important to get the numbers right, not for the total. That's valuable and important, but more for the ways that we divide the total up over time, over space, by perpetrator, by the ethnicity of the victim, and so forth.
The death toll numbers, of course, are not just a reflection of how many people died. They are also frequently political weapons. Can you give me examples of how the numbers attached to a certain conflicts have been abused by one interested party or another?
The one that comes to mind most clearly is the number of people who died in Bosnia between 1992 and 1995. During the conflict, it was often suggested, as far back as 93, that 200,000 people had died. But I remember thinking after the massacre at Srebrenica that the number was still 200,000, and many thousands of people were killed at Srebrenica. So how did the original number of 200,000 have any meaning? Well, as it turned out, it didn't really have any meaning. It was a number that was invented at a press conference and then cited, and through a process that people in my business call citation laundering, it became received wisdom. But when two different projects did two different, I think, very rigorous approaches to calculating the total, it became clear that the total number of deaths was about 100,000 to 105,000. That's a big difference. And when those numbers were presented, people rejected them on these political grounds, that it couldn't be so few. Well, why not? What does the number 200,000 mean to people? And it's interesting. We see this fairly frequently, the use of a number to signify a lot. We really don't have a clear way in our heads to make seat-of-the-pants claims about numbers that are that big.
Sometimes it's not just the bad guys who are bandying about bad numbers. Sometimes it's the ostensible good guys, like human rights groups, trying to call attention to some horrible cruelty or another. And then journalists take that number and run with it.
Well, the first question we have to ask to a journalist who's received a number is, do you care if it's right? I mean, does it matter that your story is accurate? I have had many of these debates with policymakers, with advocates, with journalists, and sometimes they say no, they don't really care. Okay, well, if you're willing to fake the number, what are you not willing to fake? Are you willing to fake video? Are you willing to fake a quote? Are you willing to mislead your reader?
They say they don't care because the particulars are not relevant. It's just a rough measure of the horror.
Journalists may defend a sloppy statistic because it's close enough. They may defend it because that's what their source said, because it seems plausible to them. When we hear a statistic, we assume that it has been done in a rigorous way. We think it has some kind of mathematical meaning. And if it doesn't have that mathematical meaning, then I think we are misleading the people that we're presenting it to. If a journalist is given a particular estimate of a total, it seems to me that they should contact an epidemiologist or a demographer or a survey statistician or a mathematical statistician or even a social scientist to ask, is that plausible? And often enough, it may not.
You are awash all the time in these statistics documenting deaths. Have you become a nerd to the human loss beneath the statistics? Have you lost or gained humanity in the process of making these numbers clearer for the rest of the world?
I don't know if I've lost or gained humanity looking at these numbers for 20 years. But I make a big effort every time I look at a data set to remember that it's not a data point. It's someone who had hopes and dreams, was trying to accomplish something in their lives, had people they loved and people who loved them, and their life was cut short by violence. In Colombia, several years ago, I was presenting to a group that included family members of the disappeared people, and a woman came up to me after the conference and said, you know, I know about disappearances in my community that no one will talk about and that no one will ever document. And she said, so their names will be forgotten soon. At least they should be counted. That's really the minimum we owe them, it seems to me, to remember that they existed.
Patrick, thank you.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure.
Patrick Ball is Chief Scientist and Vice President for Human Rights at Benetech in Palo Alto, California.
This week, the Mexican Senate approved a constitutional amendment that would give the federal government jurisdiction over the investigation of murders of journalists, taking over that responsibility from local officials who are often either ineffective or corrupt, or both. The Committee to Protect Journalists says that a special prosecutor appointed to investigate crimes against freedom of expression in 2006 has never solved a murder case involving a journalist. Eugenio Herrera is the general counsel for Grupo Reforma, Mexico's largest newspaper publisher. Welcome to the show.
Oh, thank you, Brooke.
So this new amendment has been approved by the Mexican Senate. It's likely to be approved by the states. But is it necessary?
It's necessary because police, local investigators, and prosecutors are not showing that they are capable of conducting these investigations. The people through Congress is showing concern to what's happening to journalists. It's a good start. But on the other side, what I don't like about this amendment is that it's a constitutional recognition that something is wrong in our system of justice. What I believe is that the medicine indicates a great illness in our society.
In 2010, we spoke with El Diario editor Gerardo Rodriguez, who had opined in an editorial that they weren't going to be covering the cartels anymore after the death of a staff photographer.
That's something that's really happening. Let me give you an example. We print story on our front page about things that happen in the war against the drug cartels 2,000 miles away. The local media that are closer to the event, and it's important to their community, they would not tell the story. Why? Because of the chilling effect. What, to me, is the worst enemy of freedom of speech and the people's right to know. So that is going on.
Now, a special prosecutor's office was created in 2006 to investigate the crimes against freedom of expression that were already classified as federal offenses. As I said, that office has never solved a single murder case involving a journalist. I assume that's why this authority for investigating those cases is moving to federal authorities, but that's also thousands of miles away from where these attacks actually take place. Do you think that there's any likelihood that they're going to get a better track record?
Well, experience have shown us that it doesn't, because it could be in the law, it could be in statute. For instance, in the federal criminal code, it says that homicide is punishable from 30 to 60 years in prison. But let me underline this, Brooke, provided the criminal is ever arrested. So why should this new law deter criminals or drug cartels from attacking the media if they're not going to ever get arrested, you know?
More than 40 journalists have been killed or disappeared since President Calderon launched his massive military offensive against the drug cartels after taking office in 2006. What about that offensive against the cartels put the journalists so much more at risk?
As a result of the government's offensive against the drug cartels, the result was a poisonous environment for the media to report on facts related to the drug cartels.
Because it would bring the feds down on them?
And not just that, but because there is a war going on the streets, things like killing a journalist, they would do it now because it's a mess and everybody's shooting everybody, so why not?
I was trying to think of analogies in the United States, and it struck me that killing a police officer is often punished more harshly than killing an ordinary civilian. The assumption is that cop killing is a direct assault on social stability. I wonder if this amendment is a recognition by the Mexican government that killing journalists similarly threatens society.
It is, Brooke, and it is because it's going to be a federal case now. And in fact, it's punishable harder if it's a federal offense. Then again, we also have higher prison punishments for kidnapping for ransom, for drug trafficking, and that doesn't seem to deter criminals from committing those crimes.
So harsher penalties for kidnapping somebody for ransom, that seems to be harsher penalties for killing or threatening rich people than for ordinary poor people on the street who wouldn't pay a ransom. I wonder whether or not there might be some resentment against journalists for giving them a special status under the law.
No, I don't think so, because people is very aware that killing a journalist would not only affect the journalist that was killed and their family, but society in general.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome, Brooke.
Eugenio Herrera is the general counsel for Grupo Reforma, the largest newspaper publisher in Mexico. Just before, you heard me mention Gerardo Rodriguez, the editor of El Diario, a newspaper published in Ciudad Juarez, one of the front lines in Mexico's drug wars. In September 2010, after the murder of a staff photographer, Rodriguez wrote an editorial addressed directly to the cartels. It was titled, "What Do You Want From Us?" And it was a cry from the heart. We spoke with Rodriguez in 2010, and he explained why he'd so publicly addressed the cartels.
In this war between them and the government, we are in the middle, under fire, and we're not getting a clear message why are they killing our journalists. Armando Rodriguez was a police reporter who got killed less than 2 years ago in front of his house, killed in front of his daughter. His crime has not been solved, even though we had promises from the presidency. And then Luis, last week.
The photographer.
Yes. He was shot in the middle of the day in a mall. And then the killer ran and chased his companion, which is also a graphic reporter for our newspaper. Both were wearing their IDs for the newspaper. The other photographer is alive, but he's in a secret location.
Is it true that in Juarez, only about 2% of these drug-related murders are actually solved?
Yes, it is. Only 3% get ever to courts, and less than those are solved.
So the paper's editorial read, quote, "It is impossible for us to do our job under these conditions. Tell us then, what do you expect from us as a newspaper?" You didn't really expect the cartels to respond with a bill of particulars, did you?
Well, of course, we are not expecting a direct message. This is written in an ironic manner. It used to be that they would call the TV stations and the newsrooms and they would threaten. But now, without any notice or without us knowing why, they're killing our reporters. And we just don't think a story is worth life. We recognize that they are the authority in town because the authorities are non-existent. The cartels are not just criminal, you know, sometimes they're politicians. We're recognizing this fact, which everybody talks about in Mexico, but is not published very often.
You've said that you hope that this story will get a lot of play in the American media. What do you think they can do to help?
Well, not just in American media. We receive calls from everywhere, London, Canada, Latin America, from people who tell us that we're very courageous to publish the feeling of the people of Juarez. We're very angry, very sad. We don't know who to go to. Also, let me tell you, yesterday, a lot of people just got fed up with the authorities that they're not doing anything. So they killed two criminals with their own hands, you know, just caught them and in vigilante style, they just took their line to their own hands.
What would be the ideal response to your editorial?
This war is being fought over our city. The use of drugs are increasing in the United States. We're all responsible for what's going on in Juarez. The criminal cartels are worldwide, and there's not a unilateral solution to this. It's not a Mexican problem. It's an international problem.
Do you see a future for reporters in Mexico reporting on the drug trade? Or do you think that there's simply nowhere to go from here?
Our reporters are very courageous. They're using bulletproof vests now, and we just bought life insurance for some of the reporters. And they're very courageous. The people in Mexico are very courageous. Mexican society is getting fed up with this violence. And even though right now I'm hopeless, I think that things are changing.
Gerardo, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Gerardo Rodriguez is an editor for El Diario in Ciudad Juarez.
Coming up, if I say choice of a new generation, you say...
Instant cereal, of course. This is On the Media.
On the Media is supported by Reputation.com with tools designed to help lawyers, doctors, and business professionals protect and improve their online reputations. More about controlling online reputations at Reputation.com. Support for On the Media also comes from the Pew Charitable Trusts, working to forge nonpartisan agreement on the facts and figures of economic mobility. At PewTrust.org, the Poetry Foundation, celebrating 100 years of Poetry Magazine, online at PoetryFoundation.org, and the Wallace Foundation, a source of ideas for improving education and enrichment for children, both in and out of school, at WallaceFoundation.org. This is NPR.
This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. Starting Monday, you may start to notice some pretty horrifying public service announcements featuring former smokers suffering from tobacco-related illnesses. The graphic advertisements are part of a new campaign from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. The campaign is called Tips from Former Smokers, and its goal is to encourage Americans to quit smoking by showcasing the dreadful consequences of a smoker's lifestyle. Dr. Thomas R. Frieden is the director of the CDC. Dr. Frieden, welcome to On the Media.
It's great to be with you.
These ads have been described as unprecedented, but there's a certain eerie sense of deja vu for me. I remember when I was just a kid, many hundreds of years ago, seeing images of people with tracheotomies, for example, in anti-smoking material I saw in school.
This is the first time the federal government is running a national campaign, but these are absolutely tried and tested ads. The kind of ads that we're running have been proven to work in New York City, California, Massachusetts, and in countries around the world. Graphic images that show the reality of the disease and disfigurement and disability that goes along with smoking help smokers quit.
There's a truism in the field of life insurance advertising not to focus too much on death because people automatically block the message. They're in denial and refuse to confront the possibility. The psychology is interesting. There aren't pictures of funerals and caskets.
Everyone figures they're going to die sometime, and death tends not to be as motivating to smokers as realizing that they're likely to be disabled and unable to do the things they want to do. One of the men in this ad series has had multiple heart attacks and talks about how he never thought he would never be able to play basketball with his son again.
There's another guy, relatively young man, who is a double amputee.
Yes. For every one person who dies from tobacco, 20 are disabled or disfigured or have a disease that is unpleasant, painful, expensive. Smoking costs the U.S. economy about $200 billion a year. And the ads that we're running actually amount to less than 2 days of the ad budget of the tobacco industry for an entire year. So we're being outspent, but because these show the reality that is smokers, these are real people telling their real stories, we're confident that they will encourage about 50,000 Americans to quit smoking.
There's one spot in your campaign featuring a woman named Terry. She's 51. She's from North Carolina, and she's a mess. Tell me about Terry.
Terry describes what it's like to get ready for the day.
I'm married, and I used to be a smoker. I want to give you some tips about getting ready in the morning.
She describes putting in her teeth, putting on her wig.
Then wig. Then your head wig.
Putting on her machine she uses so that she can speak without touching her trachea.
And now you're ready for the day.
And then she says, and now you're ready for the day. This shows if you survive the chemotherapy, if you survive the surgery, this is the kind of disability and this is the kind of unpleasantness that you'd have to live with.
In the category of no good deed goes unpunished, while statistics show that similar campaigns have been effective in getting people to quit, it's also created a backlash from smokers who complain that the ads are not only alarming and take a psychological toll, but demeaning to them and humiliating.
We carefully tested these ads with groups of smokers and got their feedback on what would be most effective at encouraging people to become smoke-free. Two-thirds of smokers say they want to quit. Most smokers try to quit each year. Most Americans who have ever smoked have already quit.
Some results were just released suggesting that teen smoking is still a big problem. And yet teens, at least those 14 and under, have really never been exposed to the kind of cigarette marketing that was so ubiquitous, certainly for most of my life. Due to litigation and settlement, cigarette advertising has essentially disappeared, and yet the problem continues. Is this a habit that at some point is just beyond the reach of public service messages?
We can make huge progress reducing tobacco use rates. What it takes is effective programs. Despite the sense that there isn't marketing to kids, in fact, the Surgeon General's report that just came out last week concluded that the evidence consistently and coherently points to the intentional marketing of tobacco products to youth as being a cause of young people's tobacco use. So we still have a long way to go, and it's possible to make a lot more progress against tobacco.
All right. Dr. Frieden, thank you very much.
Thank you very much. All the best.
Dr. Thomas R. Frieden is director of the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. The new CDC ads aren't the only place you'll find horrific warnings against smoking. If you've bought a pack of cigarettes in the last 46 years, you've seen the mandated warnings that say, rather unequivocally, that smoking causes lung cancer, heart disease, and emphysema and may complicate pregnancy. Anti-smoking policy has so become the consensus of government and society that in 2009, the FDA was emboldened to mandate cigarette packaging featuring grisly images in plain view. Here a cadaver, here a tracheotomy, here a pair of diseased lungs. Tobacco companies sued, arguing that they were being refused the basic free speech right not to speak at all. And last month, a federal judge agreed. Steve Chapman is a columnist and editorial writer for the Chicago Tribune. He's written frequently on this issue and recently about this decision. Steve, welcome to the show.
Hi, Bob.
Tell me first, what law was the basis for the Food and Drug Administration's rule?
Well, President Obama signed a new law in 2009, which expanded the FDA's authority over these things, and it gave the FDA the right to require these new warnings, which basically take up half of a cigarette pack and have these big pictures. And his explanation at the time was that the tobacco companies go to great lengths to market to kids, you know, everywhere they play, wherever they live, wherever they shop, and so on, which happens not to be the case.
Yes, more on that point to follow. But there is some precedent, isn't there, for compelled speech in package labeling?
The basic idea of regulating commercial speech is that the government has a right to prevent fraud and deception on the part of sellers. If I tell you that I'm the best-looking guy in Chicago, you may or may not believe me, but I've got a right to say it. But if I tell you that this car I want to sell you has 20,000 miles on it when it's really got 120,000, that's a form of theft, and that's what regulation of commercial speech is supposed to prevent.
Okay, now as to the rationale you alluded to earlier that the president cited of counteracting the vast barrage of pro-smoking messages from tobacco companies, you point out in your column that that may have been true 10 years ago, but not now.
Yeah, when you hear the president talk about this, you kind of think he's back in the 60s when he started smoking. And the tobacco companies spend very little money on what we think of as advertising anymore. Most of their marketing money goes for price discounts and promotions, coupons, things like that. Under an agreement with 46 states that they reached in 1998, the major tobacco companies can't put up billboards, they can't put signs up on buses or in trains, they can't sell apparel that's got the logo on it, they can't use cartoon images, they can't sponsor concerts or NASCAR races, things like that. Of course, it's been a long time since they've been allowed to advertise on radio or TV. So basically, the only time you'll see a sign advertising cigarettes is if you walk into a gas station or a convenience store. And even then, there are restrictions on the size of the signs. When President Obama was a teenager, teenagers could buy cigarettes. Now, in every state in the country, the minimum age to buy cigarettes is 18 or 19.
North of the border, the government does actually mandate these graphic images. Have they long been on cigarette packs, and how's that going?
They've been on cigarette packs since 2001. Cigarette smoking was declining when they mandated those warnings, and it's continued to decline. And there doesn't seem to be any effect on youth outcomes, anything like that. There are a lot of countries that have done various types of warnings and restrictions on advertising and so on, and none of it seems to make very much difference, according to the research.
These facts undercut the president's argument for why we needed this law that he signed, but the judge was concerned with a separate legal issue of compelled speech. What was the essence of his ruling?
The government has a right to compel speech when it's providing basic, truthful information about a product that's, you know, relevant to consumers. And in this case, the government really went beyond that. And in fact, the government itself sort of admitted that. And it said, we want to turn every cigarette pack into a mini billboard to warn against smoking. And it's pretty obvious that the goal is to disgust people and repel people. And that's very different from just making sure that people have adequate information to make an informed decision about whether or not they want to take certain risks.
In your column, you applauded Judge Richard Leon's decision. You quoted the great Supreme Court Justice Oliver Wendell Holmes.
He was actually writing in a case, and I believe it involved the draft during World War I, and he said, the great principle of free speech is freedom for the thought we hate. And it's hard to think of many forms of speech that more people detest than what the tobacco companies put out. And of course, this decision is going to be appealed, and eventually probably the Supreme Court's going to have to resolve whether or not this judge got it right or not. I would bet that the Supreme Court will say this law goes too far in compelling speech by the cigarette companies.
Steve, thanks very much.
Thank you.
Steve Chapman is a columnist and editorial writer for the Chicago Tribune. For years, Pepsi was the choice of a new generation. That iconic tagline was made famous with ads throughout the 1980s, including this one featuring Michael Jackson.
You're grabbing for the magic on the run. You're a whole new generation. You're loving what they do. I put a Pepsi in the motion, and that choice is up to you.
Now it appears that with a new generation comes a new choice. The instant oatmeal brand Better Oats is repurposing Pepsi's old tagline, using it in a new marketing campaign. The move appears perfectly legal. Pepsi says it hasn't used the line since 1991, and the company's registration on the trademark expired in 2006. But is it a good idea? Linda Fisher is corporate communications manager for Mom Brands, formerly known as Maltomeal, the parent company of Better Oats. Linda, welcome to On the Media.
Thank you, Bob. Happy to be here.
Okay, so you guys did some dumpster diving. You took a disused tagline from PepsiCo. What were you thinking?
Well, we registered the trademark when we discovered that Pepsi had abandoned it. We did that in 2009, and it really went in what we call the good idea drawer. And we were in our second year of promoting Better Oats. You know, you can't replay what you did in year one. It's not new. It's not interesting to the media. We're putting this campaign together, and we thought, we still don't have a hook. And we remembered what we had in the good idea drawer, and that was choice of a new generation.
I don't know what your advertising budget is. I imagine it's something close to zero. Your marketing program is built of spit and baling wire.
Spit and baling wire and some good ideas to garner media coverage and social media word of mouth. That's really where we spend our time in marketing. We do that because our whole mission as a company is to provide better breakfast at a better price. So what we don't spend on advertising, we give back to the consumer in the way of great cereals, great tastes every morning at a great price.
Is there anything else I can do for you, Linda? First, I am fulfilling your PR vision by having this conversation with you on national radio. And then I just let you do an ad for Mom Brands. Is there anything else I can do for you here at On the Media? Oh, yeah. Let me play your jingle. 23 flavors celebration, the choice of a new generation. So tell me the mechanics of this.
We went to a crowdsourcing company who put out a creative brief to their creative network, and we sat down and watched over 100 60-second videos submitted, and we thought, well, we'll go with this amateur named Josh Anderson, a guy in black pajamas with white piping, doing a song and dance act, singing a song about 23 flavors of better oats.
Now, you registered the trademark and, you know, paid the government whatever, $100 to make it yours, but that doesn't necessarily end Pepsi's legal claim against it. It can claim residual goodwill and say it is so associated with our brands that these people really don't have the right to it, no matter what their registration says, and take you to court.
They probably would have objected when we registered for the mark, because that's typically when the objections surface. And they didn't do that.
In a perfect world, the best thing that could possibly happen to you is for them to...
would be to have them sue us.
Yeah. This publicity you're getting for free right now would be a drop in the bucket. Is that the plan?
No. We are not baiting Pepsi or Quaker with the trademark. They didn't object when we registered for it. We have it. We're having some fun with it. And we didn't have to pay for it.
Now, with the stipulation that this is not the Lord's Prayer we're talking about, it's a tagline for sugar water, I'm curious if there's any risk of backlash. How dare they expropriate something that I remember so fondly with respect to Pepsi-Cola?
Boy, I doubt it. That's a bad answer, Bob.
No, that's a very good answer. Linda Fisher is the spokeswoman for Mom Brands, formerly known as Malto Meal. So, Brooke, I was thinking.
That's never good.
Yeah, I was thinking about this retreaded slogan thing.
Yeah.
You know who could use some good slogans?
Go ahead.
The candidates for the Republican nomination.
Because none of them's really been able to hold the public's imagination?
Exactly.
Okay. For instance, what did you have in mind for Ron Paul?
The Calvin Klein perfume. Between love and madness lies obsession.
Go on.
Okay. Fiat, the Strada. Fiat Strada had one that would work perfectly for Romney. Hand-built by robots.
How about, I liked it so much I bought the company. Or how about Heinz Foods?
Heinz Foods?
You know, 57 varieties of Romney.
Okay. L'Oreal, because he's worth it. Yeah, wait, you got anything for Newt Gingrich?
Coors. The silver bullet. Huh. More of a musket ball.
He has some checkered marital history. Maybe Playtex.
The bra?
Lifts and separates.
Don't forget Santorum. Like Hebrew National, he answers to a higher authority.
Or, yeah, you know the Urban Dictionary?
Yeah.
With a name like Santorum, it has to be good.
Okay, who gets Home of the Whopper?
All of them.
That's it for this week's show. On the Media was produced by Jamie York, Alex Goldman, PJ Vogt, Sara Abdurrahman, and Chris Neary, with more help from Louisa Beck and Rob Schoon, and edited by Brooke. Our technical director is Jennifer Munson. Our engineer this week was Andrew Dunn.
Katya Rogers is our senior producer. Ellen Horn is WNYC's senior director of national programs. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. You can listen to the program and find transcripts at onthemedia.org. You can find us on Twitter and on Facebook. And go to onthemedia.org to see the latest videos in our Media Scrutiny Theater series. On the Media is produced by WNYC and distributed by NPR. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
Hey, Brooke, when are we doing Obama?
Soon enough.
And I'm Bob Garfield.
Support for On the Media comes from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, the Ford Foundation, the Jane Marcher Foundation, the Overbrook Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio. This is NPR.